Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and Bob Carr makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been a long-time supporter of the Institute and was there on our first night when we opened the Institute in 25 years ago, in 1989, and he's been back many times since then. So Mr. Carr's here on the occasion this time of the publication of Diary of a Foreign Minister. And as I briefly introduce him, I just remind everyone, I don't need to remind anyone really, but I just say Bob Carr, former long-serving Premier of New South Wales, former Foreign Minister in the recent Labor government, and talking to us tonight on Diary of a Foreign Minister. Mr. Carr, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jared, thank you very much for that welcome. I wouldn't have been here to the Sydney Institute more than anyone else, but I've been here in more different roles than anyone else. State opposition leader, expected never to be premier, a premier, an author, a foreign minister, and now a former foreign minister, deposed so ungratefully by the electorate after a mere 18 months in the job, and now we're now at the University of Technology, Sydney, in a virtually full-time basis, heading what will be a think tank on the Australia-China relationship. Great pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute, which I've worked with and respected for its contribution to intellectual life in Sydney over many years. Anne's forthcoming book on Menzies deserves all our attentions, and good luck with that, Anne. Menzies is fascinating. I remember speaking to the head of the Hollywood lobby once. He was I'm just groping for his name. He was a staffer under Lyndon Johnson, and he was a legendary figure speaking up for Hollywood outside politics. And he spoke to me about Menzies, about coming to Australia. And he came and he had dinner at the US Embassy because he was out here to set up Lyndon Johnson's visit. And Menzies was the other guest. So this would have been 1966. He said, conversation with Menzies was mesmerising. Just mesmerising. And a friend of mine remembers being taken as a 15-year-old to hear Menzies speak in the 1963 election. Menzies was a great town hall orator. He loved it. He did it even plunging into the town halls in the Hunter Valley when the communists controlled the area in the late 1940s, almost at risk to his life and limb. But here in Sydney in 1963, he was speaking with all the confidence that came with someone who knew he was going to be re-elected for yet another term. And a left-wing school teacher down the back of the hall, Menzies said something like, "You'll be goodbye to such and such, goodbye to such and such." And the left-wing school teacher interjected, "On Saturday, it'll be goodbye to Menzies." Menzies paused and he said, "That dear boy would be a triumph of hope over experience." And everyone laughed as they were expected to laugh at Menzies' response to an interjector. But we've lost something. Menzies treated his audiences with respect. He developed a speaking style. He projected his communication skills out of respect for his audience. It was as if he knew there'd be people listening to him in party rooms, in town halls, in the parliamentary chamber itself, and he'd speak to them with respect. And I think we need to recover that. As a nation, we are pretty slovenly speakers, but I think the Menzies lesson is, treat your audience with the respect they deserve, and they'll laugh with you when you've got an interjector down the back. Why a diary? It's unethical. In large measure, it's unethical. I recreate in this, I reproduce in this, text messages between me and my Prime Minister. It was a disagreement Julia and I had over how we should vote in a vote in the UN between Israel and Lebanon over responsibility for an oil spill. Now, there was no doubt that the Israelis had caused the oil spill. On the other hand, there was really no value for the General Assembly in this. It was a matter of international law. But I'd given a commitment that we would vote with Lebanon. Julia learned about this and moved in to overrule the foreign minister, as prime ministers do. And backwards and forwards goes our text messaging. Julia, motion on Lebanon oil spill raises no Palestinian or Israel security issues. In that context, I gave commitment to Lebanon. Need only abstain. If opposed, we will be with half a dozen only. Terrible signal to the Arab world and with other votes to, and without other votes to Arab background voters. Can you take a minute to reconsider this? She replies, in an EAS session, East Asia Summit. The re-resolution, Australia has always voted against it. No reason has been given me to change. We do need to discuss Middle East issues. Had a good chat with Obama. We'll ensure we do when I get back, Julia. Julia, not so simple. I, as Foreign Minister, gave my word, etc., etc. Reply from her, Bob, still in EAS. My jurisdiction on UN resolutions isn't confined to ones on Palestine and Israel. Any shift of significance needs to be checked with me. And our only refuge on ones, blah, blah, blah. Julia, but one, and so on. Now, it is unethical to reproduce this. But there are several outweighing considerations. One is the public's right to know. I think the public has a right to know this. And not only when the next Snowden or Manning, courtesy of lax American security, decides to fling all our secrets into the air and watches The Guardian and other sources pick them up and print them. So I think the public's got a right to know. And second, that exchange does not put Julia in a bad light. Not at all. It's just that she's got a different view from a foreign minister, and she's expressing it as forcefully as I expressed a contrary view. No one comes out of it bad. And three, I don't think I could explain to readers the ebb and flow of an argument between me as minister and the Prime Minister I'm serving without reproducing the gritty detail of that exchange. And she doesn't come out of it badly. There's nothing embarrassing in that for her. She's just got a different view. So a diary of necessity has an immediacy. It's got a rough and ready quality to it. It's not a burnished, considered, crafted memoir. I'm trying to read Robert Gates's memoir, Defence Secretary under George W. Bush and then under Barack Obama. I'm finding it pretty hard going. However, if it had been produced as a diary, oh my God, that cheap wine they serve at White House functions, I had half a glass too much, now I wake up with a goddamn hangover, and I'm off to that meeting on X or Y today at the Pentagon, it would have brought it alive for me, for every reader, because it would have had the quotidian detail, the granular detail of a life that enmeshes us in a diary. You think of Alan Clark's diary? Anyone read the diaries of Chips Channon? He was around at the time of Neville Chamberlain, and to his disgrace, a supporter of Neville Chamberlain. He confided to his diary, my dear beloved Neville. He talked about going off to that great tawny male paradise, the House of Commons. On September the 3rd, with the outbreak of war, his first thought was of his wardrobe, and he looked at the cupboard. He said, I have 55 suits. He said, even with the most astringent clothes rationing, this should see me through any war. So it's just loaded with personality. It's just loaded with personality, and if you can't go as far as Pepys or Boswell, you should at least have some personality in a diary. So the day-to-day immediacy, the details of daily life, which do interest us because we're all human, and the personalisation are what bring a diary alive. So I prefer the diary form, and I think I love history, as I'm sure everyone here loves history, and I just think having been involved in the process, one has an obligation to share it with the Australians of the future, with the historians of the future. So that answers the question, I think, why a diary, with all the limitations I concede of a diary. But it is better reading than a carefully considered, nurtured, page-by-page memoir. I knew I was going to be foreign minister for 18 months. I wanted in that time not to build new architecture. There's enough architecture. We've got APEC and the G20 and the East Asia Summit and the European plus the East Asia Summit and ASEAN plus one, plus the UN, plus other multilateral fora, the Pacific Island Forum. There's enough architecture. Half the world is in the air at any one time attending these meetings, certainly in Southeast Asia. We've got enough architecture. It's too easy to invent new architecture. A diplomat said to me once, he said, what you ought to think about is a community of the South. I said, what? He said, you know, South Africa, Chile, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand, a community of the South. I said, for God's sake, what would we talk about? So no new architecture. And I wanted, my instincts were to steer away from anything that smacked of an Australian hectoring or lecturing style. Put it down to conservative instincts, but I thought it might be appropriate to veer away from that. And third, I wanted to win, if possible, that ballot for the Security Council, but by projecting Australia's personality and taking it as it came. I was somewhat pessimistic about whether we'd get there. I wanted to elevate our relations with Southeast Asia, and I wanted to rectify relations with China without appearing ruffled, and certainly without appearing panicky, because I thought that in late 2011 we'd probably got the emphasis in our relations with China a little wrong. Here's a surprising conclusion I'll share with you. The relevance of the Commonwealth of Nations. When the Cold War was at its, in the 1980s, when the Cold War was roaring ahead, a few people formed the notion, maybe Gerard remembers it, of a community of democracies. People used to say, we've got the UN. If you sit down at any UN forum, you're likely to be there with a police state next to a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship, next to a military dictatorship. It's not exactly a gathering of nations, the hearts of which beat as one when there's talk of separation of government, the agencies of government, civil liberties, or fair and independent elections. Why not a community of democracies, an international organisation that only democracies can belong to? Well, what dawned on me as I chaired, I had the honour of chairing a meeting of the 55 or so Commonwealth nations in London, as we agreed on a charter of the Commonwealth, was that this is what we've got. As I looked around that big table in that, I think it was Marlborough House, Lancaster House, it could have been, every one of the nations there was a democracy. Indeed, they would be stood down, locked out of our meetings, if they suspended elections, as Fiji had done, or appeared to be suspending elections, as the Maldives appeared to be doing at that time, or ditched democracy completely, as Zimbabwe had done, suspended from the Commonwealth. And they want to be in the Commonwealth. And by signing up to this charter, and I was thrilled to be in the chair to get it approved, we were entrenching this practice as written Commonwealth rules. You've got to be a democracy. You've got to respect these principles, otherwise you will be excluded. And it occurred to me that suddenly we've got here the very organisation we used to talk about in the 1980s, a community of democracies. It's got other values as well. No nation is on the periphery. No nation is at the centre. They're sitting together with the foreign ministers of Solomon Islands and Solomon Islands and I'm trying to think of the small island developing state he was with, not the Maldives, they were out at the time. And I thought, there is no other forum. About half the Commonwealth nations, think of the Caribbean, were small island developing states. And I thought, this is quite remarkable. They've got a forum, the only forum they're in, which grants them this level of respect. Seychelles was the nation I was reaching for. Solomon Islands and Seychelles. Foreign Minister for the Solomon Islands gets round his electorate on a canoe with an outboard motor. Foreign Minister of Seychelles, a former Olympic swimmer called John Paul Adam, swims the ocean, towing his three-year-old daughter with him. I said, aren't you afraid of... Yes, he said, there have been some bull shark attacks. He said, I'm reconsidering this. He said, however, they've only gone for tourists. I thought, oh, well, they're obviously... The bull sharks there seem to be more educated than the rough-and-ready mob we put up with in the estuaries of Australia. But they were there, sitting together, equal status with Nigeria and India and the United Kingdom. A remarkable forum. No centre, no peripheries. And I think a very good forum for us to participate in, and one where Australia, I'm not just saying this because I had the honour of being placed in the chair at that meeting, but one where Australia can speak with quite a bit of authority. You take the Seychelles, for example. We've really delivered for them on anti-piracy activities, and when one ship went missing, they lost a third of their year's supply of fuel. Piracy. And we've got a lead role in fighting piracy in the Indian Ocean, around the Horn of Africa, and the Solomon Islands, of course. John Howard deserves enormous credit for his intervention that rescued them from wholesale civil war, the Ramsey intervention. So there's a notion that I don't think you would have heard from anyone else. The Commonwealth, as a community of democracies, and a very valid forum. Here's another notion I'll share with you, and that is that arises from my experiences making policy on Sri Lanka. There is no clash between human rights and protecting our national interests. On the two occasions I had speaking to the Sri Lankan leadership, one with President Rajapaksa on a visit in December 2012, and the other with their visiting Foreign Minister Perez in 2013, I was able to raise a full list of our human rights concerns, seeking assurances that the process of reconciliation after the tragic civil war would continue apace, and that they would faithfully implement something they signed up to, which is the reconciliation document, a benchmark for achieving a reconciliation of the competing forces. But bear this in mind. Sri Lanka has a lot of critics. But bear this in mind. This country had 35 years of civil war. America had a four-year civil war and took over 100 years to patch up the damage. Sri Lanka had a civil war where the Tamil Tigers, if they had succeeded, would have carved out in the north of the country a state that could quite conceivably have resembled Pol Pot's murderous regime in Cambodia. Tamil Tigers introduced suicide bombing, and when their bombs went off and claimed 100 lives, the world looked the other way. It barely got reported. The world ignored this tragic civil war. And I've had meetings with the Tamil community and meetings with Labour MPs who reflect the influence of Tamil voters in their electorates. And I've said to them, I respect what you're telling me, but the Tamil narrative isn't the only one. There's another narrative about this civil war. The Rajapaksas, speaking for a Sinhalese majority, have won two elections, and they got support even from conservative Sinhalese. The Rajapaksas represent a more left-leaning party. The votes of more conservative Sinhalese, because they did bring peace at the end of this civil war. Now, the Canadians pressed me hard to be able to go off and threaten a boycott of Chogan. Chogan was held in Sri Lanka late last year. The Canadians are responding to a big Tamil presence in their electorates. Now, I said to John Baird, their foreign minister, John, we've got a Tamil presence here as well. But I'm explaining to them that we think we can do more by engaging with the Rajapaksa government, by supporting the holding of Chogan and continuing to press them on human rights. If we walk out on Chogan, say, send only a minister, not our prime minister, or if we attempt to boycott it altogether, you're simply going to isolate them and bring out isolationist instincts. And we've got real interests in Sri Lanka. We've got real interests there. One of our interests is in seeing that we get the cooperation of their authorities in stopping the flow of irregular migration out of its ports. That's a legitimate interest. We don't want more deaths at sea. We don't want a growth in people smuggling activities. We don't want to handle more cases on Christmas Island. That's a legitimate Australian interest. I want to be able to pick up the phone to the Sri Lankan foreign minister and press this case. Stop those boats. Deal with us through regular immigration. And we were able, I think, to see progress in Sri Lanka, an improvement in conditions in the north of the country, the return of land, withdrawal of the winding down of a military presence, and in Colombo, the ebb and flow of Tamil and Sinhalese communities in a way that denies some of these extremist allegations about it being an apartheid state. We found no evidence of the people we returned there being imprisoned or being detained. People who failed to make even a claim for refugee status. So I think every time I've spoken about my book, it seems I've got a question about Sri Lanka. But there have been my cautionary warnings here. Engagement is better than isolation. There has been progress, and allowance must be made for a very destructive civil war. Some of the critics of the government don't seem to be making that allowance. Nonetheless, as long as we're engaged with them, we should continue to press firmly our interest in seeing progress on reconciliation in the wake of what was a horrific civil war, although one that the world chose at the time to ignore. Let me speak about Southeast Asia because I tried to elevate our relations with it. I'll never forget sitting down with President Thein Sein, the president of Myanmar, and telling him that Australia was not simply suspending our sanctions, but lifting our sanctions. I accepted the sort of feedback we were getting from ASEAN countries that the progress in Myanmar had been close to irreversible, on the cusp of being irreversible. One of the happiest days of my life, I went from Yangon out into the Delta country towards Aung San Suu Kyi's electorate. So it was an area of very small farms. I was going out there to inspect some Australian aid projects. We were equipping the country's schools and training the school teachers. And bear in mind, one measure of this country's poverty is that only half the population will complete primary school. They just absorb that. If half the population doesn't complete primary school, then they're barely able to read messages on health or on improving farm productivity or participating in the political process. So I thought it was a marvellous advertisement for Australia that we were setting up these schools. So I went into one school to see these little kids in their blue and white uniforms, their hair plastered down because the foreign visitor was a big deal and they're told to be on their best behaviour. There were a group of parents and one had a National League of Democracy t-shirt on. And I said to our ambassador, I said, let him know that I met the lady yesterday. And so the message went across and back came the reply. He said, he knows, he saw it. He saw it on TV. So I thought, if a visit by the Australian Foreign Minister to Aung San Suu Kyi is getting run on TV, and out of the Delta country they've picked that up, then this country has changed. And we ought to start giving some credit to Thein Sein, the brave reformer who is delivering these changes. So we lifted our sanctions, and we undertook to persuade the Europeans to do the same. And that took a lot of lobbying. But they changed. The EU lifted its sanctions. That meant investment able to flow in from Europe into mines and factories in Myanmar. And the other intervention was to change the wording of the resolution that's just carried automatically every year in the General Assembly about Myanmar. It didn't give them any credit for the journey they'd been on. Now think about the role of ASEAN in this. The President of Indonesia goes to Myanmar and he says, the role of the army is in the barracks. That's President Yudhoyono as a force for democracy in the region. There's a lot of promise in that. I thought ASEAN, the advice we had from ASEAN was basically correct on how we should deal with Myanmar. And so we opened up to Myanmar, and I was thrilled when the foreign minister of Myanmar said on a visit to Australia, and he meant it. He said, "We see you as Asians." He said, "That's how we see it. We think Australians are Asians." He saw us as part of the community of the region. And that was a move towards, I think, the gradual integration between Australia and the ASEAN world that is part of our future. Because this is a vision, I think, that should unite us all. Just think of the ASEAN world in 20 years, if things go right. I'll come to the Thai coup in a moment. If things go right, just think of the ASEAN world. If they continue on this trajectory of economic growth, expanded middle class, and improved social indicators, e.g. proportion of girls who get to finish school, family size, proportion of girls who get to go to university, percentage of the population getting post-school degrees, they've had tremendous progress, just about all these countries. If they continue, well, there's a guarantee virtually of Australian security and Australian prosperity. A region of resilient nations enjoying economic prosperity, moving to first world living standards, getting middle income status, approaching the standard, aiming to get to the standard of Singapore or Taiwan or South Korea. Their supermarkets stocked full of Australian produce, Australian goods. All the planes going into these capitals full of Australians, going up there to work as engineers, as town planners, environmental advisors and so on. They're buying Australian services. Our universities full of their students. Their universities full of Australian students. This is a vision of an Australia that is integrated with Southeast Asia and with obvious implications for our prosperity and our security. Well, what could go wrong? Well, first of all, governance. And think of the coup in Thailand. There's a country that is so economically promising. So economically promising. Terrific work ethic, efficient industries, a very favourable country for foreign investment, for example, from Japan, beginning to develop multinational companies. I spoke to four of them aiming to achieve multinational status by investment in Australia, by buying Australian assets in power, in wind farms, in food, in financial services. Very exciting. And yet just failing because the opposition parties in Thailand can't accept the results of elections. And can't do what happens in mature democracies when, if you lose, and having been through September last year, I know what that's like, I know how traumatic it is. If you lose, you just go off, empty the office, fill the packing cases, go off, and plan for a day when you'll win. Put together a strategy to get yourself back. The Thai opposition can't accept that. So they've got to produce a crisis, stopping people actually getting out to vote and draw in the courts. And draw on the military in interventions. So there are challenges for governance in these countries, and often governance is a polite word for corruption. Systemic and large-scale corruption, so that even a candidate for the presidency of Indonesia shared with me his concerns about corruption as a tax, an indirect tax, on every level of economic activity throughout Indonesia, and being a major barrier to it achieving middle income status or moving beyond middle income status. Think about an opportunity and a challenge in Southeast Asia, and it's the reform process in Vietnam. Were Vietnam to open up its economy as China did and to reform its politics, here would be a dynamo. Think of a country and a people that has defeated France, the United States and China in wars. A population of around about 100 million. I went to a university, RMIT campus, outside Ho Chi Minh City, and every student I spoke to was doing something like business communications or marketing. I said to a group of them, "Hey, this is supposed to be a Marxist-Leninist system." I said, "Oh, that doesn't worry us. We've just got to get that marketing degree and go on to Princeton." I thought, if the country opens up, it would be terrifically interesting almost overnight. We pressed human rights cases with them, famous cases that the Vietnamese community in Australia put to me. I've got to say, whenever I met the Vietnamese foreign minister, he took up the cases. We got a response. We've got an annual human rights dialogue. with Vietnam. But it's very interesting where a blogger can get as more readers than any official newspaper in the country. So there's an energy there waiting to be unleashed. It could be one of the riveting stories out of the region. With Indonesia, I think one of our goals has got to be to nurture a block of opinion, mass opinion in Indonesia, that is well disposed towards Australia. We don't figure as big with Indonesia as they figure with us. It's our biggest embassy, our biggest aid program, and all the other checklists, all the tick the other boxes. But they look elsewhere for the outlines of a foreign policy, one that's based on the non-aligned movement, on relations to their north, looking towards the Indian Ocean, and so on. But I think it would be a mistake if we allowed too big a weighting for intelligence and security matters to have us lose sight of other interests in our relationship, like continued police cooperation, counter-terrorism, building madrasas that provide a moderate Islamic education, as opposed to those would be provided by Wahhabist money and influence. That's part of our aid program at the present time. And getting Australian investment into the country despite the impediments of infrastructure and governance issues and building trade. I think all that will come as they achieve 6% annual economic growth and build a middle class. But I think the standoff we've got in relations at the present time ought to be quickly wrapped up in the same way the Americans resolved it. These misunderstandings out of the Snowden revelations. That would be my advice for the Abbott government. And then we can get back on the job of seeing that in Indonesia, no prejudice or paranoia about Australia is allowed to take hold. I had a meeting with some Indonesian editors in Parliament House in Canberra, and I ended up saying to them, you don't really think that anyone in Australia wants to partition the two Papuan provinces from the Indonesian Republic, do you? And there's some scepticism. I said, it would not be in Australia's interest. Again and again, I've said these are human rights issues for us, and your president and your foreign minister have always been committed to dialogue with us about human rights issues in the two Papuan provinces. We have never seen it as a matter of sovereignty. That's very important, because there would be, in corners of Indonesian public opinion, people who would doubt that assurance and think that Australia, and dwelling on East Timor, would think that Australia is part of a Christian West that would seek to dismember an Islamic Republic. I'm not saying that I've ever seen that reflected in official Indonesian opinion, but I'm looking at how we can nurture, to the extent we can at all, a sympathetic Indonesian view in mass public opinion towards this country. This book could have been abbreviated and just run as a book about America. I have a lot of reflections on the US relationship in this book. And I quote a couple of diplomats who advised me. One said, we ought to aspire to be a different kind of ally. By that he meant an ally that is as close to America as it's possible to be. So I quote that, and I return to that. And then there's a view of a very wise public servant, Dennis Richardson, who said, when we were talking about the lead-up to an annual meeting with the Americans, he said, our interests aren't always the same as those of a great power. Between those two expressions, I think you've got the room where we move when it comes to our relationship with the US. I described in the book, sitting in the General Assembly of the UN in September 2012, when President Obama was speaking. On September the 25th, he addressed the Assembly. He committed his speech as a little memorial to Ambassador Chris Stevens. Chris Stevens was the US ambassador murdered in Benghazi. And it was a time when there was a lot of attention on that YouTube video that mocked Islam. And President Obama said, we find it repugnant. America's a religious nation. We find attacks on religion unpleasant. Yet we do not ban blasphemy against our most sacred beliefs. We do so not because we support hateful speech, but because our founders understood that without such protections, the capacity of each individual to express their own views and practice their own faith might be threatened. He says more speech is the answer to offensive speech, not less speech. It's a very eloquent speech. And as I sat there, I thought any Australian would subscribe to this. And this was a reminder that common values between Australia and the US are very real. But I reminded myself, a little corrective here, I reminded myself that there is a less happy side to America's international character. And that is, while I'm inspired meeting a Kerry, a McCain, a Zelik, a Hillary Clinton, equal number of Republicans and Democrats there, and their sense of responsibility for what happens in the world, I've got to banish from my mind George W. Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Sarah Palin, Newt Gingrich, and the ghost train of Fox News horrors. I think there'll be an opportunity to explore some of these things in question time. I'll just wrap up, Jared, by quoting Kurt Campbell, the former US Assistant Secretary of State. He said to me once, I said to him in Washington, I said, Julia Gillard's very, very buoyant about our visit to China in Beijing. I said the Chinese committed themselves to guaranteed annual meetings, their leadership and our leadership, and we call it a strategic partnership. I said there'd be no reservations about that in this capital, would there? He said, no, no. He said, Australia should just be the most desired girl on the block. He said, be courted by both of us. And I think that's a useful warning to the present coalition government. You don't have to minimise or contain the opportunities of a robust relationship with China to appease Washington. They would think there'd be something odd about us not going full bore on building a relationship with China, because they regard their bilateral relationship with China very, very highly, and they see it as a great success. I'll conclude with something else Kurt Campbell said. He's a great friend of Australia's. He said, in respect of something, he said, of course, Australia's got a very successful foreign policy. In saying that, he wasn't referring to the policy of the government I was referring in, but to continuity of Australian foreign policy over the decades as reflecting the interests of this country, of this Australia. And he added this, although it would make Australians very uncomfortable to hear that. In other words, his impression of us is that we're such worriers, so nervous, so gloomy in our disposition, we couldn't see that decades of making foreign policy has basically got us into a reasonably secure and successful position in the world. And in fact, I gathered the impression over 18 months that we're entitled to say, as a middle power, we punch above our weight at the upper end of middle powers. There's no really convenient term for it. I searched for one. South Korea and Mexico and a few others said perhaps we should start describing ourselves as pivotal powers, thinking of the upper range of what could be captured by the middle power spectrum. But the argument wasn't resolved when I got voted out of power and returned to private life, where you find me now. And it's a great honour to speak to you tonight. Thank you.
Many thanks to Bob Carr. We'll now come to questions and discussion. But first, I should say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this fine facility. There, you can have something on the way out. The former foreign minister has already lashed out and ordered a hot water, and if you go downstairs and tell them that Bob Carr sent you, they'll prepare you a plate of steel-cut oats. Very popular since the publication of Diary of the Foreign Minister. Janet Grundy's got some copies today, and I should also say that all the proceeds of the book are going to Interplast in Australia and New Zealand, which is a medical organisation that works in the plastic surgery area in needy countries. So now we come to question and discussion. We'll finish on the top of the hour because I've got to go off and watch Fox News at that stage. Couldn't live without Bill O'Reilly and the team. But if you just come up here, a question from one of our strong supporters, Gus Lehrer, who didn't come tonight, but Gus sent me a note and he said, look, I've read the book, I've read about the Israel lobby. He said, but the only instances in the book where Bob Carr says that the Labor government was influenced by a group within Australia, decisions that it made because of its concern of Labor members in Western Sydney about the Muslim and the Arab populations in those areas. You mentioned foreign policy, it also applies in social policy. So how do you respond to that? That in your book, I think there are three instances where you say we had to change this policy because of the Muslim and Arab populations in Western Sydney and the local members from Western Sydney are knocking on the door on these issues. So that's a Gus Lehrer question.
Yeah, no, that's not an accurate description. That's not an accurate summary of the position here. I reached the view that on a couple of issues, we would depart from what our policy had been. For example, we'd be explicit in criticising the spread of Israeli settlements on the West Bank. Now, in the early pages of the book, and this is where Gus is wrong, I'm called in New York by an officer of the Prime Minister's office, Bruce Wolpe, who says, you put out a statement criticising the spread of Israeli settlements, will you have a telephone conference with, quote, the community, unquote, about this? And the community was the Australia-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And I said, no. I've laid down the Australian position. Again, and this is spelled out in detail in the book, from Bangkok Airport, I'm sending a message back to my advisor, James Larson, saying that statement I want to put out criticising the latest burst of settlement activity on the West Bank. You recall that I proposed using language identical to that used by UK Foreign Secretary William Hague. Where's that gone? The message was, well, yesterday the Prime Minister said the statement couldn't go out until a couple of people had looked at it. But the view today from our office is that there can be no statement. I said, what, not even an expression of concern with settlement activity? And back came the response, no statement at all. Now, I will argue anywhere that the spread of settlements, and there's been a doubling of the settlement population in the last 20 years since the Oslo Accords, is a major destabilising fact in trying to get what the Pope spoke about 48 hours ago, a peace between a Palestinian state, he used the expression, a Palestinian state, and Israel. And I would argue that it's not in Israel's interest that there not be a Palestinian state. So this is spelled out carefully and in detail in the book. And to me, our vote on Palestinian status in the UN to give them the status of observer status, and the question of settlements was absolutely an Australian foreign policy interest. Now, I got to say, even when this came to a showdown around the cabinet table, there's no one saying, "Oh, this is a matter of going after Islamic votes in Western Sydney." There were people in the caucus who said, I favour that proposition. I've got a big Arab population, but that's quite legitimate. I mean, they're not sub citizens. They're citizens entitled to a view on foreign policy. But challenge. I'm going on too long here. But my challenge to AJAC is this: you got someone here who's supported Israel over the decades, who's opposed to a boycott, divestment, and sanctions policy against Israel, who's had arguments, publicised arguments with Palestinians who opposed the separation barrier, which I've supported because bombs were going off and Israel was entitled to protect itself, but who disagrees with Israel on two propositions, Palestinian status in the UN and wanting to express opposition to this wretched policy of spreading settlements on the West Bank. If you brand me your chief enemy, then you've lost a sense of proportion.
David.
Thanks for the comments.
Bob, just stay here.
As you pointed out, Australia has lots of interactions with different countries, particularly in our region, but also beyond. And as you actually finished up with your formal remarks, we like to think of ourselves as punching above our weight. But what's the evidence that other countries see us as punching above our weight? Is it actually our impression of ourselves rather than actually a true sense of the influence that other people see us potentially playing from there?
Yeah, there is a bit of that. On the other hand, I'll give you a couple of examples. The Caribbean is a long way from Australia. But when I went to sit down with the 40 nations of the Caribbean and make a pitch for their votes in the lead-up to the Security Council ballot, this would have been in September or June 2012. The ballot was on October the 18th. I said, we've got these in common, interest in climate change, interest in the marine environment. I declared the first marine national parks in Australia, coincidentally. We support an arms trade treaty. It's a big issue with the Caribbean. And Kevin Rudd put a small amount of money as a token towards a monument to the transatlantic slave trade. I walked out of that door with 14 votes of the Caribbean in my back pocket for Australia. And they had a lively interest in and affection for Australia. They liked our international character. The ambassador from Grenada got up and she said, on all those things, we like Australia, but that support for the monument to the transatlantic slave trade, we expected no less from a country that delivered the apology. So, I mean, that's us punching above our weight in the taking 14 votes of the Caribbean away from Luxembourg or Finland and putting them in our pocket. Just very quickly on Africa. Our investment in Africa is pretty minimal. Our aid is 1,000 postgraduate scholarships a year, but they are highly valued. And from our point of view, they mean that an African elite, decades from now, will have been educated in Australian universities. Just 1,000 a year. It's a good investment, and bear in mind, we've got $50 billion in mining investment, Australian companies in mining investment, either in the ground or proposed across Africa. So we've got that. Whether we punch above our weight was really measured by that Security Council ballot. In being one of the seven major sponsors of that arms trade treaty, we demonstrated, and being a lead nation on chemical weapons that gave us credibility on the Syrian chemical weapons issue, I think we're justified in seeing ourselves at the upper end of a middle power spectrum, but there can be elements of self-delusion in how nations see themselves, and it'd be wrong to think that we're on the top list of most nations' key relationships.
Now, we've got a lot of questions and we don't have a lot of time, so right down the back, got to be brief. Yep.
There's an unaddressed...
Just speak up a bit.
There's an unaddressed issue here. Your host has written about the diary about a critical issue that you've mentioned already. That issue hasn't been addressed, which is that in 2001 you told your host, publicly, that you would now consider the establishment of the state of Israel as a state. And I'd like to report to that.
We've got to be brief.
If I can just ask you other questions about punching Obama away.
No.
There's a wonderful YouTube clip of Barack Obama meeting endless world leaders, saying every one of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, we've got to... Yeah.
I know what you're referring to. I don't recall saying that to Gerard. It is possible for sincere people to have different recollections of exchanges. All I can do is point to my record. I have had arguments with the Arab or Palestinian side as often as I've had arguments with people who I think have been unrelenting on the Israeli side. And I would defend that balance. I'm interested in what's a viable position for Australia on Israel-Palestine. And I don't see it as feasible, and I argue this when this comes out throughout the book, that we not criticise Israeli settlement activity. And indeed, I would be using the language of two former Israeli prime ministers. Indeed, I'd be more moderate than they. I'd certainly be using the language that William Hague uses regularly when talking about the same issues. So it's not a surprising position. My challenge, I'll finish with this sentence, my challenge to the Australia-Israel Public Affairs Committee is to give up the argument about settlements because it's not sustainable, and on that they have lost Australian public opinion, and to gravitate to issues, a defence of Israel as a democracy, a defence of Israel as a champion economic performer, a an opposition to boycott, divestment and sanctions. That would be far more fruitful ground than trying to argue in defence of settlement activity.
Okay, there's a question here and a question there. We've got to be quick. Yes?
Yeah, very quickly. But DFAT, does it have the capacity to do what a foreign affairs minister wishes it to do?
That's a tough question. I think it's been said that DFAT is challenged when it comes to great creativity with ideas in foreign policy making. That said, there aren't that many great ideas out there. If there's a formula, for example, on Israel-Palestine that hasn't been explored, I'd be very surprised. It's very hard to find fresh notions in the world of diplomacy. If there were a criticism of DFAT made by others, not by me, 18 months, you'd give a management consultant more than 18 months to reach something definitive, it would be in the area of intellectual creativity and ferment. But I don't know. I think I would settle for the sort of good workmanship that I think is a characteristic of DFAT. I've got to say, I was very impressed not only by DFAT, but also by ASIS and AusAid. I don't think any nation would have more competent professionals.
There's a question here, and then here. We've got to be quick.
Barbara, coming back to the Palestinian thing.
I think we've covered that pretty extensively.
I just want to ask his opinion, though. Do you think that the two-state solution will ever come about?
Well, that's the toughest question that's been asked tonight. There was optimism around. I recorded in my book when John Kerry threw himself into this, the latest attempt to get it. The Palestinian perspective is that the prospect of a state of their own is vanishing as more and more settlement blocks get thrown up. And more Palestinians are persuaded to sell their housing to settlers. The Israeli perspective is that, unpleasant as the continuing occupation is, as Netanyahu put it to me when I met him, I recorded in the book, he opened the curtains or the blinds and he said, "I don't want to see Hezbollah out on that hill." So the Israelis are prepared to live with a pretty lousy status quo rather than risk that Palestinian state. And the rest of the world can only look on in horror at the degradation of the Palestinians, the fermenting unrest, and Israel having to degrade itself to preside over an endless occupation. But the sort of things that are happening to Palestinian youth and the settler violence.
Question here.
Carol, I say this in light of President Obama is going to give a speech at West Point later this week, so it's in light of that we don't know what that is going to say, but China seems to be a lost at the moment. It seems to be antagonising its neighbourhood greatly. And the US seems to be hardening its position vis-a-vis China. Do you have anything to say in relation to that?
The most worrying position in Australia's international setting is the maritime territorial disputes in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. The American position, restated in recent months, is that their defence treaty with Japan extends to those islands, although America underlines that it is neutral on the very issue of sovereignty over the islands. My own prescription for Australia is that we need to continue to enunciate very carefully our neutrality on both cluster of maritime territorial disputes. A lot of people have made analogies with the uncertainty of July, August 1914 and the prospect of a similar misunderstanding and of miscalculations like those of 1914 arising from these simmering tensions. I find it deeply worrying.
There's a question in the middle there. Got to be quick. Yes.
I'd like to bring you back to your comments about the UN. As an outsider looking in, it looks like the almost the lunatics have taken over the asylum with this huge block that is controlling everything from human rights to a whole bunch of other things and coming up with the most insane outcomes. What's your attitude toward how does that get resolved?
Yeah, my frustration with the UN was Syria. I put to the senior leadership of the UN that in the absence of a political deal over Syria, a ceasefire and a transfer of power to an interim authority with full executive powers and then an election, in the absence of that, surely we can negotiate to get all sides of this conflict to agree on getting medicines into the country, medical convoys, making hospitals a no-go area and giving protected status to doctors and nurses. I thought this medical pact championed by Australia would be so obviously of benefit to this desperate people, polio re-emerging in the country, for example, because they can't get vaccination, doctors and nurses being shot in the doorways of hospitals because 2 days before they had treated wounded militia from the other side. Surely we can get an agreement on medicines, medical personnel and hospitals. I couldn't get from Special Envoy Brahimi any movement, any flicker of interest. And that left a very sour taste. In the absence of a political agreement, and I accept you had to have agreement among the big five on the Security Council, the permanent five on the Security Council, surely, as the minimalist contribution to relieving the suffering of the Syrian people, a medical pact. The UN could not deliver that.
Right, so there's a question down there. We've got to be quick and then up against the wall. Yeah, I think that's about it, yeah? You've got to be quick.
Oh, yep. Good to see you. Yeah. Very quickly, were you surprised at the imminent caveat on the release of the book, at the manner in which it was treated? That is pretty much by journalists to stay. And just very quickly, given that you acknowledge as well it's unethical to publish it, is it any more ethical that Peter Archer in effect called you a liar without revealing the source? Which you and whom you must regard well, because you quoted him on page 242 as giving an accurate portrayal.
Okay, yeah. Right. So there's a question about the reaction to your book, in particular Peter Harch's comments.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed the tabloid response to the book, and it spiked sales wonderfully. And my view as a fighting politician of state politics is that if you're getting savaged on the tabloids, you just set your alarm clock, and you're up before anyone else, and you spring onto every radio station and own that territory and turn things around. So a few days after the Telegraph front page called me a first-class tosser, I was speaking to a radio audience, an FM radio station, that unbelievably has got a listening audience at 8 o'clock in the morning of 500,000, which is five times, I think, twice as many people who read the Telegraph. And then I was back in the Telegraph's pages having fun with them, reviewing economy class travel on Qantas, Sydney to Brisbane. So I regard the tabloid stuff as fair comment and very helpful to the sales of the book, which is now in its third run. But the Harcher thing, I just thought it was unethical on his part, quite unethical. He was very close to the Rudd camp, and without consulting me, he put on the front page of the Herald that I had shifted grounds. Now, I had, as I record in the diary, I had. But if he'd spoken to me, I would have said, Peter, I advise you not to do this. There's no way I'm going to confirm this story, and in any case, in Washington, about to meet the Vice President and the Secretary of State, I'm not going to give the world another glimpse of an Australian Foreign Minister dashing to the Willard Hotel at midnight to summon a press conference and resign. It had happened 12 months earlier with Kevin Rudd. I wasn't going to do it again. Now, I think he should register that loud and clear before he then engages in this vendetta journalism directed at my book. But someone who survived for 20 years in state politics, it really is bad taste to complain about the media, and I've gone too far. It's breached one of my rules. But you invited it, and as I treated your questions in the House, I always treated your questions with courtesy in the House and gave you full answers.
I think that courteous end is an appropriate time to end. There are many more questions here, but we're right on the hour, so I think I should wind up and just say to to Bob Carr. Many thanks for an entertaining performance tonight following the publication of an entertaining book. There's some copies of Diary of the Foreign Minister here. I'm sure Bob Carr would be...
The precious first edition.
It's now in its third printing. And I think Janet Grundy managed to get the first edition, being an optimistic bookseller. So anyway, that's here. And to say to Bob Carr tonight, many thanks, and I'm sure you'll be back again in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.